welcome to the Modern Maker Podcast for Thursday, August 6th, 2020, otherwise known as, actually didn't look up a day today, so it's going to be a Q&A episode with Sean and I. The Joshua Tree boys are not here. So let's just hop right into a question. You guys, I asked for some on Instagram and you guys sent in a lot. So we're just going to try to go through them in order. There's no way we'll get to all of them, but we'll just try to hit as many as we can. So the first one is, can you sell plans in Argentinian pesos? Ja, 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 ja. Which luckily I speak Argentinian. That translates to ha, 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 ha. And we can. And it would be like 6,530 Argentine pesos. But actually, I will say, Sean, you can chime in. Just say hi so people know that you're actually there.
Hello.
All right. See, I'm not talking to myself. We do consider the rest of the world. And with the plans from the get, we have had metric and imperial versions of the plans. But anyway, answered that one. Let's go to the next question. Okay. This one has nothing to do with, actually it does have to do with making. Which supercar is best for makers? Criteria: two doors, mid-engined, no truck debates. What's your pick?
A supercar.
Well, I guess it's anything that's two doors and mid-engine. So like an MR2 would be a supercar by these,
you gotta standards. Have something that has some storage, or like if with an MR2, you could smash out the back window and put like some 2x4s.
Well, so that's what I was gonna say. So some of you may know this. I've had several S2000s, which is a convertible. So technically there's no storage limit vertically. Mm-hmm. So you could carry a infinitely long board in there in theory. And the front, or the engine, even though it's in the front, is behind the front axle. So I think that might technically make it mid-engine.
Wow, we're really grasping here.
S2000.
I'm going to consider my, I just bought that Volkswagen pickup truck. I'm going to consider that a supercar.
It's a front engine diesel, yeah. 68 horsepower.
Two doors though.
That is two doors. It's actually very small. It's light. It's stripped for racing. All right. Fair enough answer. We'll both just choose our own cars. Yeah. Let's see. Do you guys collaborate on projects from the start or only loop each other in for refinement? I guess it's kind of a mixed bag.
Yeah, I think it depends on what we're doing, but
yeah, I would say like for the stuff that's four plans, there's probably more inclusion early on because there's so many different factors to consider. Whereas like, you know, if it's just a YouTube video or if it's something that has to do with a client or something like that, then like you're probably going to kind of have to figure out 80% of it that's going to be a certain way, or like you're going to be doing the whole reason you're going to be doing the project is because you had this initial idea that kind of dictates a lot of what it is. But I would say like at this point, probably every project has at least some input from the other person.
As we've been, you know, as time goes on, I feel like we get more and more where from, you know, earlier on in a project's design phase or whatever, we're going back and forth more. Whereas, you know, when we first got together, it was, we kind of still had these, our separate things going. And now like as things become more integrated, we're in each other's, you know, things a lot more.
Yeah. I will say also, and I think this would come across much more if you were like actually here building with us than it does in videos, but I would say I'm a relatively unconfident builder. So I'm very frequently like, hey, Sean, what do you think? Is this good? Is it like kind of just like making sure that I'm not doing something totally stupid?
And in the same way, I'm like, I'm very unconfident when it comes to like video stuff and like thumbnails. And so like,
rightfully so. It's terrible.
In the same way, I go to you for that stuff.
Yeah.
So it makes sense.
There you go. All right. Another question. If you had to intern for another YouTuber, who would it be? And it has to be in a different category.
Okay.
You have an answer for that?
I have one.
Let's hear it.
Okay. I wanted to say two, but I'll just say one. I'm going to go with a YouTube channel called Flight Chop.
Uh-oh, does this have to do? Sean loves planes for the uninitiated.
Yeah, it's like a general aviation YouTube channel. He gets to like fly a bunch of interesting airplanes. And so I would...
Flight Chops?
Flight Chops. Check them out.
Oh, baby. I remember the first time that Sean came down here for a collab, we walked out of the shop at one point and like he hears a plane and just like starts staring up in the air. I was like, what? Like, is a plane crashing? What's happening? And he's like, oh, I like planes.
Our shop is on the flight path for LAX. So it's just a extravaganza of airplanes.
It's like that scene from Wayne's World. Just pictured exactly like that. All right. Oh, I didn't answer that. So I think I would do probably a car channel just because it would be cool to be around a bunch of cars, you know, like two new cars every week that you get to thrash around in and not worry about. So probably that. And if I had to pick one, actually, my favorite one is this one called Savage Geese, which I think I've talked about on here before. The guy's got a pretty dry sense of humor, but he is funny. And I like the level of detail that they go into with their car reviews. So that's what I would pick.
It's a great choice.
Thank you. Not as good as Flight Chops, but they can't all be Flight Chop quality. All right. Next one, normal or XL Festool Domino. Which one? Also nice plans. Thank you. I think we're both going to have the same answer for this.
Probably.
One, two, three, XL.
Festool Domino.
What is the normal one called? Oh, like the 1500 or something like that. Huh?
500. Wait, would you actually choose the XL?
No. I just wanted to say the opposite thing. Yes, I would definitely take the small one. The big one's like for construction, I think. The small one, I've never had a time where I felt like it was too big. Or, I'm sorry, too small. But I actually have had times where I felt like it could be a little smaller.
Yeah, I get asked that pretty often. I think it's like I know when I was looking to buy one, I was like, oh man, should I get the XL? And
I don't think they had the XL when I bought mine.
Yeah, I remember it came out a while after. But there's been like maybe a handful of times, not even, where I've been like, oh, it would be nice to have.
Yeah, like what project that we've worked on where that I've been around, either that I did or that you did, where like we could have used it, or that it, not that we could, where it would have added something.
I don't even know.
I don't think any.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like what's the smallest that it can do?
The regular Domino has the like
the smallest that the big one can do. XL.
I think there's like one level of crossover. Like so it can 50. Do like 10s.
Oh, so it can do 10s. Yeah. Yeah. It's too big. If you're doing furniture, I would say definitely get the smaller one. It's cheaper and it's better in most situations.
Easier to handle.
Yeah. All right. We're actually flying through these.
Well, that's what we do.
It's like we got flight chops or something. All right. Can you discuss resawing on the bandsaw, your process and resulting stock thicknesses? No, he just said thickness, just thickness. And resulting stock thickness. You have more experience with this than I do.
Yeah, and I mean,
especially on the project you're working on now.
So I'm working on a big conference table right now, and it's got a lot of the person I'm making it for had some wood milled years ago that he wanted to use in the table, and ended up that it had a lot of rot and bug damage. So I had to do a lot of cutting up of raw lumber and then resawing and basically making veneer to get them, you know, to be able to cover this gigantic table. So there was a lot of resawing, and I don't know if my process is what other people, I'm sure like people that are, you know, seasoned veneer experts would probably do it differently, I would assume. But I guess basically, I mean, this will all be in the video, but basically I have, you know, we got a big bandsaw blade. I think it's like 3/4 or an inch.
Yeah, I was gonna say like an inch.
Yeah.
Wide, I guess.
And it, you know, I don't even remember. It was like 3 teeth per inch or something like that.
Big teeth.
Big teeth. Yeah. Like, which I don't even know if that's what is
like,
good or not.
It's like if Gary Busey was a bandsaw. It's got giant teeth.
But essentially just, you know, I have my boards. I make sure I have a square edge.
Well, I was going to say, so like just from me watching you do it for 6 days on this project or whatever. So I guess it depends on what you're starting with would be the first thing. So like saying that this guy had his lumber milled is like, it's... the least you could do for technically being milled, I would say.
He had it milled, a log milled on like a huge bandsaw mill, and then it sat outside for however many years and warped.
And probably not the right way.
Oh, no, because it was full of bugs and, you know, it was ruined, essentially.
So pretty much the first step was like building a sled that you could use on the table saw to even establish a semi straight edge.
Yeah. I mean, I first started by using the bandsaw just to rip off like all the live edge, and like a lot of the stuff right down the middle of these slabs was just completely rotted out. So I was cutting everything in half. And
do you remember, like, let's just choose, I'm sure they were all different thick nigh to begin with, but like, what was a typical thick, how thick was a typical piece of wood that you'd be starting with?
I think the raw stuff, like just the straight slabs, were maybe 2 inches.
Yeah, I was going to say, I remember them being right around 2 inches. Yeah, it seemed like
they weren't super thick or
no. And they were so warped that by the time you milled them flat to where you could like actually begin making veneers out of it, it was like almost down to slightly over an inch probably.
Some I was able to keep, you know, inch and a half or so, inch and three quarters, like the thicker ones. But then, yeah,
and
some
then it depends on how wide you're going on. Like if you shoot for thinner, you might be able to leave it thicker or whatever.
Right.
Narrower, I guess that would be.
I tried my best to, I mean, I know we have an 8-inch jointer here, so I knew I couldn't have stuff wider than 8 inches. So, you know, if I could get stuff that wide, but for the most part, everything was getting down to like, you know, 4 to 6 inches wide. So, you know, once I had it jointed and planed, yeah, I'm down to, you know, inch to inch and a half thick.
Mm-hmm.
And then having not super wide boards made resawing a bit easier. You know, if you have like a 12 inch wide board or something, makes it a lot tougher.
And then what were your finished veneers?
So I cut them to about a 16th right off the saw. And obviously sometimes they were thicker than that. Sometimes, you know,
off the bandsaw,
right? Yeah. Right off the bandsaw. That's what I was shooting for. Maybe a little over 16.
You hardly lose any material when you're using a bandsaw. You probably lose another 30 seconds or something like that.
Yeah, pretty. Yeah, honestly, the biggest place where you get waste, and again, this is for someone like me who, like, I'm not great at this. I don't have all the stuff that makes this easier. So the biggest place where I would waste material is getting like an untrue cut, and you know, I'm shooting for just over a 16th, but if I tip the board a little and I cut it a little fat, I'm gonna eventually sand everything down to even thickness, so that's, you know, I'm gonna lose a little extra there, but it's definitely I'm wasting a lot less than if I were to resaw on like the table saw or something like that.
So do you remember then, like, let's say that you were starting with like an inch thick piece of material that was good, ready to use on the bandsaw. Like, how many pieces do you think you would get out of it? Maybe 8?
Yeah, easily. Okay. Some more than that.
That's not bad.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes I would start resawing and like, I maybe wouldn't have seen it, but I'd resaw a couple strips, and then I'd all of a sudden I'm cutting into like a big old bug hole or so, you know, I would run into that.
Yeah, so there'd almost be like waste that you didn't know that was in the middle of the thickness of the material that you had.
Yeah, I don't think I ever had a board where I cut the whole thing into veneers and went like, oh, great, these are all usable.
Yeah, to give a little more background on the piece that we're talking about. So it's a really big dining table. It's like about 16 feet long, probably 4 feet wide.
Oh, yeah, almost 5, I think.
Yeah, and it has a subtle arc to it. So you can imagine the size of it. And the majority of the top, I would say, you know, 85% of it is the veneers. And then it's got like a pretty thick border on the outside of thick hardwood. But like the amount of lumber that, so the guy brought us his own tree, like we talked about. It was something that was on his property that got cut down and then milled and sat around for a couple of years. He brought it. And I think in his head, he was like, oh my God, they're going to be able to make 50 tables out of this, because it was a lot of wood, but so much of it was unusable. And like, it was one of those things that honestly, even though the material didn't cost us anything because the guy was providing it, it probably would have been cheaper from his perspective to just say, build me a table this size, this shape, and let us get the wood, because of so much extra labor had to go into it. But it's one of those things where, like, you know, a lot of times with custom furniture, I think people are just like, they're married to that story, or they want that story of like, this tree was on my property and now it's in the restaurant, or it's for a winery. So in the, what do you call it? A winery?
Yeah.
Okay. Tasting room.
He was willing to, whatever extra cost was involved with the labor made sense to him because of,
for that reason.
Yeah, it was a tree from the property or whatever.
Right. But like, and I think that in his head, like I was saying in the beginning, it was like, oh, there's so much wood here. Like he probably pictured us making this table not using veneers. Like it was going to be like fully thick 2-inch pieces of wood. I think he even said when you had asked him how thick they were, he said they were like 3 inches thick or something. And like none of them were that thick. And by the time they were usable, pretty much veneering was the only option available if we were going to stretch the wood to this size.
Yeah.
All right. Did we go through the whole process? Oh, so you would do that. Then you basically just put them through the drum sander to finish them off.
Well, yeah. So one thing that and this is where I'm not sure if this is like a normal thing when resawing, but like I'll take my board, I'll resaw one strip, and then I will run it, you know, 'cause now I have a rough face. So I'll run it over the jointer again and then take it back to the bandsaw. So again, like that right there, I'm losing a bit more material.
Yeah. Yeah. And you had the jointer set pretty healthy cut that it was taken.
Yeah. Just to do it in one pass. Yeah. And then, yeah. Okay. Then, so I have a, you know, stacks of these strips, and then they all go through the drum sander to get them down to like a 32nd was what I ended up with.
So basically, because you're not good at it or set up for doing it the proper way, you had to join it in between every pass to assure that you had at least one face that was flat.
Yeah. And I think that's probably a pretty common thing if you don't have like, you know, some sort of industrial like resawing setup or whatever. Because like, you know, I'm not gonna run the board back through the bandsaw against the fence with like a rough face.
Well, oh yeah, because otherwise I guess you'd have to adjust the fence every time, because you'd be...
No, because I'm cutting the fence is a 16th from the blade. So I'm cutting that veneer.
Right, but I'm picturing, so like, let's say that the fence, the thick part of the piece when you started was against the fence and the thin part was the off cut. Mm-hmm. Then you could keep running that same side, but you'd have to adjust the fence every time. But you would also... It probably wouldn't be a good idea because the cut that you had left over might not be a flat face, and then you're cutting another flat face just shy of that. So, yeah.
I don't know. That's how I've always done it, and you know, I've done it like that before, and it works out. You know, and then you have when you go to the drum sander, you have a nice flat side to every piece, and not like it really matters, but yeah. And then I spent like 3 days standing at the drum sander. Yeah. Running stuff through it.
I remember watching you at the drum sander looking at your phone and waiting for pieces to come out. Yeah. All right. By the way, that's Sean Boyd made this on Instagram. Go give him a follow. He's not at 10,000, so he can't do swipe up. He needs swipe up.
I'm not in there. No, I'm nothing.
Yeah. All right. Another question. Any plans on making an in-depth video on all of your different sleds or details on how you make them?
Mm.
I mean, do you have any videos that were of jigs?
Yeah. Well, I made a video on my channel a while back that was just like about table saw sleds and like, you know, how I set them up.
Yeah. Like doing like the ones that you use to cut like tapers and the template faces and stuff.
I mean, those are really all for the most part, all I use.
Yeah, I'm not like a huge jigs guy either. I know I have made a video that's more about like my favorite jigs and accessories for table saw. And like I went over quickly how I made the ones that I have. But like, honestly, the ones that I have are things that you can make pretty quickly because I'm just not really into like making this sled that I'm going to spend 2 days making and it's got every little bell and whistle. Like, if it's a cross-cut sled, I just want it to be able to cut at 90 degrees and not have to think about it. I mean, the other, like something like the one that I use to cut to carry the panels vertically on the table saw so that I can make the miters that are beyond 45 degrees. Like, that's such a simplistic sled that, you know, like if we are ever to make plans on a piece where you had to use that, I would probably cover it for something like that just so that people can achieve whatever they have to. But I feel like it's so basic, the types of sleds that I use, that it probably wouldn't warrant a video. I don't know. Maybe someday I'll want to do a big cross-cut sled, but I feel like it's already out there also. Yeah. Like, what am I going to do that isn't already out there?
And like we don't have, you know, like a wall of jigs and sleds where, you know, and also in my mind, to spend that much time making those things and saving them means that you're going to be like remaking the same part a bunch of times. And I maybe would have done that a few years ago
when selling stuff.
Yeah. But right now it's like, make the jig for what I need right now and then get rid of it. I don't need it hanging around.
Yeah. That's our stance on jigs.
That's the end.
All right.
Today's episode of the Modern Maker Podcast is brought to you by Skillshare. Skillshare is an amazing website if you are interested in learning new things. And I'm assuming if you're a Modern Maker Podcast fan or listener, then you're interested in learning new things.
Look, it's really important to invest in yourself. If you talk to anyone that's good at anything, it's because they're not just sitting on their laurels and being static. They're always adding a new wrinkle or twist to what they do. And Skillshare is a fantastic way to do that, in a way that's easy to integrate into your lifestyle.
I think it's also a way that if you want to learn something new, you can kind of expedite the process. That's where I found it really helpful in my life. It was when I was getting into making YouTube videos, and I wanted to get back into editing, which I had done a little bit of before, but I was completely unfamiliar with Adobe Premiere, which is the software that I had access to and what I've been using for the past 4 years now. So I took a class, is like a 6-hour class probably. I took it over the course of probably a week. I would say, you know, I dedicated myself pretty good to it, doing a few hours here and there every day, and got through the course and felt totally right at home by the time I was editing my first video.
That's awesome. So if you are interested in taking your creative journey further, do it with Skillshare. They've got chapterized courses that are easy to digest, and you can always go back and forth to reinforce anything that you learned earlier. And right now, for our listeners, Skillshare is offering 2 free months of their premium membership at skillshare.com/modernmaker. It's a great value, and after that, Skillshare memberships cost right around $10 a month, which is great. So once again, that is 2 months of premium membership at skillshare.com/modernmaker. So check out some courses, find some things that resonate with you, and we just want to give one more big thanks to Skillshare for supporting the Modern Maker podcast. Now back to the show.
Another one. How do you feel about people using your plans to make and then sell for a profit?
What?
So they mean make the piece of furniture in the plan and then sell for a profit. This is happening?
No. Why don't we just do that?
Yeah. Hey, we could be making more money. I honestly, I really don't mind it, if I'm being honest. I've had a lot of people ask me this question, and my stance has always kind of been like, go for it, but I don't think it's a good business model. Like, I don't think you're ever going to run a good business doing that. If it's like you want to do it just because you wanted to build the piece, but you don't need the piece, and you're like, well, I can just sell it for money and then buy some other tool or whatever, that's a fine way to go. I don't see any problem with that. Yeah. But then again, you're not like really set up for selling pieces for the most money if that's your situation.
Right.
But the reason I don't think it's a good business model is because I think, like, ultimately, if you're going to succeed doing this, there's kind of like, obviously there's more to it than this. This is oversimplifying, but I always feel like there's kind of 2 lanes that you could go in as a custom furniture maker. And that's basically where you're either being employed for your like ability to produce anything. So like somebody wants to come to you with like, hey, here's this idea that I have that I need done. You're the skill, you can get it done. Or you have this like unique style and voice or whatever that people want that type of furniture and will buy it and will pay a premium for it. Whereas doing, you know, buying somebody else's plan, somebody else's design, and then making that, I feel like that's in somewhere in this like weird gray area between that I don't think there's much of a market for.
Right. I always, you know, I get that question a lot. And in my mind, it's like, I kind of tell people, you know, if you're looking to just, like you said, sell one or sell a couple of them because you don't need it or whatever, or you want to buy a new tool, I'm always like, that's fine. You know, if you're going to just do local markets or sell to friends or whatever, like no issue with that. But like I think we've talked about it before, where if we were approached by someone who, or if we saw something online of like some company has taken one of our designs and is right. selling yeah, it mass produced, that's probably the only time I think we would really have an issue with it.
Yeah. Yeah. If anything, I guess, so I would tell somebody, if you want to try, go for it. Best of luck to you. I don't think it's going to work. I think what would probably be more beneficial would be to buy it, make the piece, and like take something away from that you can incorporate into your own thing. I think that's a more like sustainable, realistic way that it could
benefit
you from a business perspective, I guess.
I almost feel like it with these plans, I would be more, I mean, I'm very proud of them and I hope people get a lot out of them. But like, I think for me, if I had two options where people who use the plans learned how to do woodworking techniques or learned how to bring their ideas in their mind to reality, like if that was something people could get out of using our plans, like that, to me, that's so much more valuable. And I hope there's something in the plans where people do them and learn something and go like, okay, now I have the ability to take the things I've been thinking about and bring them to reality.
Yeah. It's something that we've talked about and we've even mentioned in like the introductions for each of the plans, is that we say this is basically like taking a woodworking course, except for in the end, instead of getting a certificate, you get a dresser or you get a rocking chair or whatever. That's almost like, yeah, that's the result of what you get, but kind of what you were just saying, like, I hope that it's actually more than that in terms of like what you're actually getting long-term from it.
Right.
All right. So buy them and sell, start a store. All right.
Let us know how you did it. Cause
yeah, we're not good at it. When will your loyal fans be able to purchase Bad Larry plans? I don't know when, but that's definitely on the horizon. I definitely want to do it at some point.
Someday.
Let's see. Do you guys spend time trying out different finishes or just stick with what works? Maker brand excluded.
Mm.
Sean, are you a big finish trier?
That's what they called me in high school.
The old finish trier boy. Here he comes. Hey, Sean, any new finishes lately?
Ooh,
gather around, fellas. Let me tell you. Shellac is where it's at.
That being said, no.
I do not.
No, I think I guess I tried finishes until I found the ones that
worked for me.
Yeah. I mean, obviously I'm biased towards Maker brand, but it's modeled after what my favorite finishes to that point were, which is basically a penetrating oil that's, you know, very easy to use, very easy to refinish. That was always like high on my list. And also something that like doesn't smell toxic. And the reason for that was when I was in the garage, and especially when I was selling furniture, if I had multiple projects going and before we had kids, I would use our spare bedroom to finish in. And like, if you use a finish that stinks, like it'll stink up your whole house. So that was very important to me. And then now I'm basically between, it's every project is either simple finish or a sprayed on polyurethane water-based. And that's usually for like lighter woods where I don't want it to darken at all or like amber at all. Mm-hmm. And then for plywood projects, because the polyurethane just kind of feels nicer on the plywood, I think. And
there's definitely finishes that I would like to try, but I'm...
Well, I mean, we're about to try a new one.
We are,
aren't we? Aren't the penetrating?
Oh yeah, yeah. But I don't. That won't.
I guess that's not technically a finish.
Yeah. But like, you know, you always hear stuff about like Rubio Monaco.
Yeah.
And
like, yeah.
I've never used it, and like, there's part of me that wants to try it, but then I'm like,
what if I like it though? Yeah. It's like cocaine.
Then I'm gonna have to like keep buying it.
Yeah. I'll be a junkie at begging people for another fix of Rubio Monaco.
When, you know, you got a Maker brand simple finish works just fine.
Yep. Easiest one on the market. It's right there in the name. Simple.
It's easy.
That's why we called it simple finish. Yeah. What piece are you making plans for next? So most people probably already know. So we have a desk one that's getting ready to come out.
Which is online for pre-order.
It's online for pre-order already. After that, it's kind of up in the air because it depends on other things. But I will just say, like, the things that we have planned coming out next, like, hopefully all within this year with any luck, but a dining table, some dining chairs, and we're going to try to do them kind of as a set. They can still be purchased a la carte, but, you know, some kind of incentive for buying them together. And then we definitely want to do a coffee table, and we also want to do a bed and nightstand, kind of the same way as the dining chair and dining table, where they will be a la carte, but, you know, some kind of incentive for buying them together. I think those are all of them on the horizon, right?
That's the short list, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, long, like, going out past that, and, like, you know, some opportunity could come up and change the order with in which we do them. But, like, we're kind of trying to hit all of the staple pieces right out of the gate. So, like, you know, if we do, we've already done a dresser. We probably won't do another dresser for quite some time, because we're just going to kind of cannibalize our own market if we do that. So I feel like it makes more sense to get, like, a complete catalog and then go back into, you know, maybe, like, you know, some different ideas on the same function for a piece or whatever.
Exactly.
Exactly. Have you ever done a dining table with breadboard ends? I'd love to see your technique.
Mm.
Have you done them?
I have a couple of times, but no one wants to see my technique.
Let's hear it.
It's the easy way. I just have done them with dominoes.
XL or DF500? Oh, the little guy, huh? Just get some 25 by 30s in there. No, what are the 4 by 20?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, like, I prefer to use the smallest one. So when the breadboard end breaks off, it's
a... Well, this was a dining table for chipmunks.
Yeah.
For the Garys.
I just gave them a domino, yeah, and they sat at it.
They need... Yeah, that's their dining table right there. So yeah, then
so cute.
I've never done breadboard ends just because I don't like the look of them personally.
Yeah.
I have a dining table that's 40 inches wide and 8 feet long, and the ends have not split apart yet. So
I mean,
like, how necessary are they?
I would prefer, like, if I was worried about a dining table, like, warping or cupping or whatever.
That's what it's more for?
Yeah. I think it's for that for the most part, I think.
I thought it was just to set your bread on. Why is it called a breadboard?
That's accurate.
Ba-boom.
I think if I was worried about that, I would sooner do some sort of, like, under table.
Yeah, like, put some flat bar mortised in underneath or something.
Yeah, to me, breadboard ends are not the best look. It's kind of a traditional look, which neither of us kind of fall into that.
Yeah, screw tradition.
We're trendsetters.
That's
over
right.
Here.
No breadboards. No breadboards for us. Okay, wait. Did we cover that? Did you say you cut in a domino?
It's just dominoes. You know, like, using the wide setting. So
what's the normal? What would the traditional technique to, like, route in a whole, like, spline or something, or, like, a whole?
I think like, you can do, like, basically a big mortise and tenon.
Okay,
and then a lot of people will draw bore. You know, dowels and stuff like that.
No, thank you.
I mean, it's a lot of great technique and impressive technique.
Yeah, I guess if you like the look, I say go for it. I mean, it's probably one of those things that I guess started off for function and then, like, is now probably used more for looks, because there's other ways you can achieve it, where, like, maybe whenever breadboards started being used, it was because, like, you know, glues are not what they are now. What would you call it? The acclimating the wood process is not what it is now. So there was more of a reason for it.
Yeah, potentially. Yeah.
Pretty soon they're going to be, what's the word I'm looking for? Anachronistic? Does that mean, like, something that is, I think that's the right word. Somebody look up anachronistic. I think it means, like, something that doesn't still, it's, like, not of this time anymore.
Belonging to a period other than that being portrayed.
There you go. They're going to become anachronistic. You heard it here first.
You're a wordsmith.
Yes, I am. Which of your plans would you recommend to an amateur with limited tools? I mean, it depends what limited tools are. I mean, I think all of them that we've done so far could be done with a much more modest stable of tools than what we've used.
I think we've gone into them with the mindset of, like, we're not doing DIY, home building of furniture, but we're going into it with the mindset of, like, you know, we don't want to make it seem totally undoable.
Right. If I can do it, they can do it, man.
Yeah.
I stink at building, people. You should know that by now. And also, I mean, honestly, like, I don't know, because it just, I'm sure there's people who could build what I built in the plans better than I can with worse and less tools, because they're just better at building things than I am. And then there's people who could have the greatest workshop in the world and not be able to do it. But again, like, I think that the value is deeper than just like what it is. So if you actually were like a total beginner and didn't have a stable of tools that was that big, I would probably guess, if I'm being honest, like if you just said like, hey, am I going to be able to do this? I'd probably say no, if that's your situation. Like, you're not, but that doesn't mean that they're not of value, because there's still a ton of content there and a lot to learn from it. And then like eventually you could build it.
I think we were talking about this where when, you know, when I was first getting into serious woodworking, something like, you know, not to toot our own horn, but it, just to sit down and watch these plans, I would have been super valuable, just to like see someone's process and, you know, whether or not you do it the same way or other people want to do it the same way, but just to see someone go through it and explain every little thing.
Well, okay. So actually the other, I don't know, maybe 2 weeks ago, my mom brought me two books that she found at an estate sale, you know, probably some old dude that was into woodworking at some point. And it was, there were these books probably from the 70s or 60s that were about woodworking and like, you know, learning how to woodwork. And they had like a bunch of plans in them, but like each plan is a page long. It's really not that much of a plan. It's just kind of like a design and a cut list or something. And I remember I was looking at it. It was interesting, but I was like, oh my God, it's crazy that like, this is how, if I had been born 30 years earlier, like this is how I would have had to learn to woodwork.
Right. I got a bunch of woodworking books from my grandfather, and I remember getting them, being like, oh, this is great, I'm going to read through these. And it's like, no, I'll just go on YouTube, or I'll, you know, I'll figure it out.
Yeah. I feel like there's a lot to be learned that way. And then like, I think if you do want to dig deeper and get into the nitty gritty, I think that we could probably repackage our plans that way as more of like an online course learning tool type thing, rather than, you know, build this specific, like, whereas like a one-to-one relationship where it's about building this specific thing. And I think that like, they are kind of the modern day version of what a book might be in some way. Obviously they're more focused on one thing, but
maybe someday we'll write a book.
Yeah. As a digital plan though, we'll say a digital book.
It'll be an ebook.
Yeah. I am writing the script for the voiceover right now for the desk, and I'm not done with it. And it's 40 pages single spaced. So I kind of am writing a book.
You're pushing book territory.
Yeah, it's a novel. It's classic novella length. Novella. That's all I write. I feel bad because like so many of these are plan specific, but how are your plans different or better than other plans? What's your competitive advantage? Oh man, we're both such humble guys. We can't say it. I mean, I think our designs are really good. I think that's what they're not the best plans out there. Like, they're very in depth. Obviously, like the Wood Whisperer makes plans that are equally or more in depth. Who knows? But I think ours definitely have everything you could want from it. So it kind of just comes down to like, you know, what things are you interested in? Which pieces are you interested in? And that should determine which way you go.
Yeah. I think
it's subjective.
Yeah. I think it's hard to find furniture plans for furniture that is a little different or a little more modern. You know, you see a lot of plans for traditional furniture. So I think that's something we're bringing to the table, which is kind of what that's been our game plan, you know, even just with YouTube videos or even just with making custom furniture, is like do something a little bit different or a little, you know, have a little bit of an edge to it. So
yeah, you like curves more. I'm more the guy with the edge. Yeah. Keep them straight, baby. He's a dough boy. What do you charge for labor when building commissions?
What do you charge for labor when building commissions?
Yeah, I feel like that's a hard question for us to answer now because so many other things factor in. But like, there was a time when you just built furniture. Like, how did you used to?
Yeah, I will say that, and I don't, maybe people don't think about this, but labor is the
yeah, the cost.
Yeah, the materials, the low part, yeah, of the smaller portion.
A lot of times people will be like, I'll be like, oh, you know, okay, this dining table is going to cost $2,000 or whatever.
What if I made it out of paper mache?
Yeah.
They'll be like, well, okay, well, you know, what if we use oak instead of walnuts? It's like, okay,
it's going to be $200 cheaper. Yeah.
So yeah, labor is the cost essentially. And there's definitely no like equation or formula for it that I've ever used. I just kind of, as you get more jobs and build more stuff, you just kind of go off your gut and like.
So that's how you were doing it. You weren't even like, do you think you were even saying like, oh, okay, this will probably take me a week or something?
Yeah. But like the way I was coming up with that was like, okay, I know I can build a table in a week or whatever it is. So, so I'll charge what I think I should get in a week's worth of work. And also a lot of the times I just went, okay, a dining table, like, cause there's small things that I make that are.
The heck is that?
I think, is it the cleaning people coming into the.
Oh, great.
They're rock and roll.
The building next door is getting cleaned. So if you hear background beeping and music, don't mind it. Sorry, you were saying?
I was saying that there's some smaller things I make that are much more intricate. But I can't really charge $2,500 for a one bar stool. Whereas, but you know, the bar stools I make are fairly intricate pieces and like there's a lot of work that goes into them. So there's that part of it too, where you can't factor in labor. You have to just think, what's a bar stool sell for? What's a dining table sell for?
Yeah, that's kind of a weird part of it. And that's why I think like this is kind of a tangential question to this that I may have said this on the podcast before, but like if somebody was digging a little bit deeper into that question. So like if your goal was just like, how can I make more money as a woodworker?
Mm-hmm.
Like selecting pieces that have a perceived value by the client. So like beds have a higher perceived value than a lot of other things, even though they're not necessarily any harder, don't take any more time to make.
Well, and that's a good point also, like when, you know, the perceived value is high because they're big and they take more material. But when you think about it, you know, like lumber cost for a coffee table compared to a dining table is maybe only a couple hundred bucks more or whatever,
right.
but the price you can get is,
right,
you know, much, much larger than that.
Yeah. So there's almost an exponential profit, possibility in as the pieces become bigger. So my go-to for this is always like, me and Sean have definitely talked about this. If all of a sudden everything disappeared tomorrow and we just had to start making like furniture or doing something with the skills and tools that we've acquired, custom front doors. So the only people who need them are usually pretty wealthy to begin with. And it's like something that if you'd set your tools up and have tools that are like very specific to doing that. And I think that you could probably have like a pretty quick turnaround for something that has a high value or a high cost.
And that's also actually, that's a good point. And doors, that makes a lot of sense. But I mean, I guess this is just like manufacturing in general, but if you're able to somehow go like, okay, I'm going to make a furniture business where I only make dining tables. And you know, they could have little differences,
right,
but if you're just set up where, you know, you can knock out a dining table in 3 days,
right,
you know, that's going to be, but I feel like that's like, we're stating like something so obvious of,
right,
like, that's just.
Yeah. It's basically not being a jack of all trades, I guess, which is like what most of the one man shops want to do. And like what we both did and wanted to do. And that's because like part of the reason that you get into it is because that's what you enjoy doing. So that shouldn't be discounted either. Like there may be something to, you know, making only 70% as much, but getting to do all the different types of builds that you want to, like maybe that's of more value and you're a richer person because of that.
If we were just out here making front doors all day, I don't think either of us would be nearly as.
I want to slam my head into one of them.
So that's, yeah.
Yeah. But getting back to like the root of the question, what do you charge for labor when building commissions? I guess that's the other reason that we're bad at answering this question now, is there's so many other factors that are being weighed. Like, well, the heart of all of it is, what do I want to do, and like what will make for a cool video. And so I'm much more likely to take the job of a person that's offering me less money because it falls in line with everything else that I'm trying to do, rather than, you know, just getting the most money for something but not being able to do everything else that I need to or want to do.
Right.
So, yeah, I guess that's what would be equivalent. It's like by nature, or yeah, because of what we do, we're going to get questions that have to do with like running a furniture business, even though that's not exactly what we do. Like, what would be a good analogy would be like, I don't know, going to like a restaurant and asking the chef, like, how do you grow carrots?
Yeah.
So, yeah. Like, they probably know more than the typical person.
Right.
But...
right. And like, you know, to be fair, we have both been
in the background, yeah, but we both also switched out of it.
Right. Right. So, and like both of us switched out of it before we had become super successful. I mean,
right.
You know, like we both were doing fine, but like certainly not, you know, prolific.
So who, okay, let's like think of the people who are successfully doing it and not being specialists at doing, you know, something like the front doors or whatever. Mm-hmm. So like, Jory would be, yeah, a great example of that. So like, I mean, you worked with him for a while. Like, does he take on commissioned pieces that are just like the type of stuff that we would do too, where like this random person just wants this like very random project? Or is it more like, hey, I've seen this thing you do, I want you to do that again for me? And like, maybe there's slight differences.
I definitely, well, yeah, like I think he, I mean, and I worked for him. I think people would go to him because they like his aesthetic. Mm-hmm. You know, he wouldn't do stuff that was just straight up.
Yeah, it's not like build me this high boy or whatever, right, they're called.
But like when I was working for him, we were building a bunch of display cases and stuff for like a jewelry store in Beverly Hills. And, you know, they wanted it to be in his style, but it was, yeah, it wasn't like he was building credenzas and coffee, right, tables.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I guess that's like how you get to the point where you're getting people are paying you as if it's like art, mm-hmm, more than like it's a utilitarian object in their house that's used for some kind of function.
Right.
Is like if you have such a unique style and you're so good at, and like at the, you know, upper 0.01% of people who are doing this, and then like people will pay that premium because it's by that person.
Right.
So that's what you got to do. Super easy.
Just do that.
How long will exposed plywood ply be popular? I got wood on the mind, people. I'm going to start again. How long will exposed plywood ply be popular as a design feature? I mean, did it? So like, when did plywood start being used commonly? Would have been like in the 60s or something?
Yeah, probably.
So, I mean, maybe before that, maybe the 50s. I mean, like, it's definitely in style now, but it's more of like a niche style still, I would say. I don't think it might, like, you know, become more and less popular or whatever, but I think it'll always stick around because it's not just an aesthetic. Like, it's there for a reason. It's a byproduct of the way that it's produced.
Well, yeah. And I mean, I know like there's the exposed edge of plywood. People do use it as like a feature in some things. I don't think though it's so common where you're it's like, oh, all I see is plywood edge, right, and then all of a sudden everyone's gonna be like, that's so 2020.
Chipotle too much.
Yeah. Where like, you know, oak kitchen cabinets, right, are just scream a certain era or whatever. So yeah, I think it'll come and go in popularity, but it's never enough where we'll be like, oh, plywood edge is dead.
Right.
You know, no one's doing that anymore. I think it'll always kind of be around.
Yeah. I think the general category that it falls into for me is like, not that it's a natural thing, but natural things tend to stay not dated, or tend to not date themselves as much. So like, I mean, like, yeah, I don't know, like something like maybe granite countertops or something, right? Like do those ever truly go out of style? Like maybe certain like edge details and certain colors of them or whatever, but like not just because it's granite.
Right. Right. Yeah. Nailed it.
Nailed it. All right. Let's do one more.
Okay. Make it a good one.
All right. Well, I'm doing the next one. So how do you handle silly requests from friends and family? Example, can you make me a $20 Target item?
Yeah, that's a common one.
Yeah, I've gotten pretty good at saying no to people.
I have not.
Yeah, you're not as good at that.
I'm not good at that.
I've seen some of the stuff you've brought in.
Yeah. So how do you handle it if you've gotten good at it?
I just get comfortable with saying no, I guess.
Well, what's your, like, do you have a reason for it?
I think it's easier now because it's like, it doesn't fall. I can't, like, I'm running a business and I just don't have the time to do that because I have so many other obligations. That's always a good one.
Right.
My kids are sick right now. Popular. Nah. But yeah, like, I don't know. Like,
what about when someone comes up to you and go like, look at this cutting board I found in Target. You could make these so easily. They sell them for $35. You could just crush with this.
Yeah. I just say, like, oh yeah, that's a good idea. I'll do that. And then I just don't talk to them anymore. No, I think that, I mean, honestly, the one that I just said is like what I would do most of the time. Otherwise, I mean, like, I don't know if you want to have the conversation, like if it is like a family member or a friend, like you could just explain like why, like, oh, that'll take me this many hours to build. Yeah, people never realize that. Like, so, okay. If I get that question from like a client, which does happen from time to time, like, hey, I saw this, like, I'll just straight up tell them like, oh, I can't do it for cheaper than that.
Right.
Like, you know, I don't know why they think that it's possible that you can, but
yeah,
I do not waste any time even toying around with that type of question because it's a losing prospect.
Right. I basically now that we have so much going on, it is a bit easier to say, I really wish I could, but I'm sorry. Like, I just have way too much going on. The times where I basically feel like I cannot say no. And this does not happen that often because my close family and friends know,
right?
You know, so they're not asking me for those things. But like, you know, if my grandma was like, I would love it if you made a cutting board for me so I can give it to a friend, I would be like, okay, okay, grandma. No.
Are you still alive? Jeez. Make you a stupid cutting board.
So, you know, that's one of those situations where I'll just, you know, I'll stay late one night and make a cutting board or something like that. I think you're right. When you have enough stuff going on, or just lie about it. Say you're super busy and you can't do it.
Say you lost all your tools. What about like, okay, so you're at an age, I would say, where like in the next, you know, 5 to 10 years, probably like a lot of your friends will buy houses and stuff.
What's that supposed to mean?
That you're an idiot. No, that they'll probably be hitting you up for stuff.
Oh, true. They do.
They do?
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, like in that situation, I would just tell them like, yeah, I can. I mean, this is different than the $20 Target item, but like, say like, hey, if you like the stuff that I build, then you trust me and I'll build you something cool. And then that way you can like get to build the thing that you want to build.
Right. And I do like, kind of what you're talking about. I do have a lot of friends, you know, we're at that point in our lives where people are buying houses and they're making money
where they can,
you know, buy nice things and stuff. So I've gotten a ton of people who go, oh man, like I'd love to get a table from you. I'll hit you up, and it often never goes anywhere. Or I tell them, I'm honest. I say, yeah, that's a $4,000 piece or whatever. And they go, oh no, okay, I'll let you know. You know,
as soon as they say they'll hit you up, you just change your number and all your social media names. Yeah. Yeah, go ahead. Hit me up.
I run off to Mexico, never heard again.
Yep, he's out there spending Argentine pesos. All right, loops it back to the beginning. I think that's a good place to end it, huh?
You should go on tour with that. All right,
well, I will. In Argentine.
Adjusted for the road.
Sure. That's the, never mind. I'm not going to even explain it. We'll see you next week for a normal episode. Bye.
Bye.